We saw that that there were various different types of courts at the beginning of the period that we were studying, and that these were of three kinds, namely the local courts, which themselves subdivided into various different types, and then there were the courts centrally authorized, and then there was voluntary courts. All of this, of course, in addition to the Roman courts, which were So you have, as Dr. Cahan Sr. told me immediately after the shiur, in fact, the article by Alon that we have been studying in Hebrew has been translated into English, so we could hand out English versions of it, which may be more or less legible to some. So here they are.
Thank you.
All right. And then we left this discussion, I believe, last week with the quotation from the story told in the Yerushalmi Sanhedrin. Rabbi Abba said, originally, each sage used to ordain his own disciples. When Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai ordained Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yehoshua, and the latter ordained Rabbi Akiva, and Rabbi Akiva did the same for Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Shimon. But then they reconsidered and paid due deference to the house of the patriarch, declaring that if the court ordained the judge without the approval of the patriarch, the ordination is null and void, while if the patriarch ordained without the consent of the court, his act was valid. His act was valid. Finally, they reconsidered, declaring that the court should not give minui without the consent of the patriarch, and the patriarch should not ordain without the consent of the court. And remember what Alon's comment on that was. I suggest that by the ordination by individuals, was really ordination by and behalf of the court, and that the whole thrust of the statement by Rabbah was to record a stage in the struggle between the Sanhedrin and the patriarch over the power to ordain. Not only that, but it seems likely that even originally it was the practice to get the consent of the patriarch. The issue became whether or not that consent was a sine qua non. As far as Rabban Gamliel is concerned, is on record that he did ordain, etc., etc. And What was Alon's final overall interpretation of the picture? It was that originally the power to give smicha was in the hands of the Sanhedrin, not necessarily of the individuals. And then during this time, when there were centrally appointed authorities, which were ordaining of so-called official judges, there was a conflict between them and the local courts, the courts that were constructed in one fashion or another from the local communities, and mainly manned by people who were not versed in halacha, and therefore, more or less, one had a triple system of justice, one of the Roman administration, the other of the ordained rabbis by the Sanhedrin, the Mumchim, and then finally the local unofficial courts appointed by the local judges and administering neither Roman law nor Jewish law. Alon's interpretation of the sequence of historical events was that one of the major innovations that Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi and his immediate successors engaged in was a process of co-optation. That is, instead of to fight ideologically the existence of a local court system, it was actually to appoint many of these local judges as official judges, despite their ignorance and despite the fact that they seemed to be dealing with another mode of justice. And this was an enormously politically astute move, because instead of fighting an ideological battle, what actually happened was that he drew these local justice system within the control of the central authority, eventually cementing the power of the halacha as a legal system. And since you have these handouts, I might as well read some of the things in the current English handout alone. This gives me a real opportunity here. To revert to the first topic, I'm reading from page 425 of Dr. Kahan's handout. To revert to the first topic, the appointment of non-qualified judges on the part of the patriarchs first of all meant that the problem of recognition for judiciaries in the settlement of an unsealed civil legal system for commoners had finally been solved. We have seen before that, from the time of the sages of Yavne and onwards, the attitudes of the Tanaitic world toward the standing of these courts had become polarized. Some upheld while others denied their authority. In awarding these judges ordination, in quotes, the patriarchs were only confirming the existence of an ancient social tradition, even though it had elicited protests from many of the Torah scholars. Secondly, the elevation of local judges to the level of the ordained was likely to abolish the rivalry between one judicial authority and the other in regard to their respective realms of authority. From now on, the courts of the commoners were equal to those of the judges and were able to try all civil cases, including penalties. This fact meant the removal of a complicated and quarrelsome factor from urban Jewish life. This recognition afforded by the patriarchs is significant mainly for its regulation and strengthening of the democratic tradition in the judicial world, the granting of power to civil judicatures. Never heard of it. In actual practice, however, these appointments were mainly allotted to the ruling classes in these cities, i.e. to the country aristocracy. The opposition of the sages to the appointment of such judges was also a link in the chain of their rivalry with the powerful classes in the cities of Eretz Yisrael for the influence in and control of the settlements. And if we skip to page 427, just two pages down, yet another factor also operated here. In the period under discussion, the process of consolidation of the ruling status of the wealthy elements in the cities of the Roman Empire reached its culmination. Henceforth, the state, that meant the Roman Empire, granted them additional legal rights in the colonies, which had become transformed in the course of time into legally endorsed hereditary rights of these families. There came into being that defined, crystallized class of buletai, curiales, as opposed to the plebs, who had lost the right to participate in city government. Burdensome responsibilities and obligations, however, were also forcibly thrust upon these classes. The buloti were compelled to assume the responsibility for the administrative and financial obligations of the populations of the cities and their environs. The combination of additional privileges and heavy responsibilities led to the centralization of communal supervision and caused the administration of the cities to fall into the hands of the above-mentioned classes. Certainly, in theory, this development only pertained to communities organized in the form of the poleis. Three cities of this type were added in Eretz Yisrael during the rule of the Severan dynasty, most of the population of these cities being Jews: Lod, Diaspolis, Emmaus, Nicopolis, and Bet Gurion, Eleutheropolis. Moreover, the continuation of the process must be assumed to have occurred even in the larger settlements, which had attained a broad measure of autonomy, even though they did not officially rank as poleis. This situation most likely helped to make the rich elements of the settlement the basis of organized national structure in Eretz Yisrael. On the other hand, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi also instituted a number of regulations designed to consolidate the realm of the sages. Although these actions of his led to the enforcement of the mastery of the patriarchs and some denial of the freedom of the former, nevertheless, it was he who facilitated the increase of their influence in the cities, their appointment as communal leaders, and the consolidation of their rights. The reinforcement of the communal status of the sages, however, brought about an intensified religious educational endeavor on their part in the towns, in cooperation with and under the supervision of the patriarchate, and Torah study, which became immeasurably intensified. There ensued a certain saturation of spiritual influence within the broad strata of the nation, a rejuvenation, as it were, affected by the Torah scholars and stimulated by the patriarch. All these efforts enhanced the power of the sages and prepared the way for the powerful position in the future, both vis-a-vis the secularized wealthy elements and the patriarchs themselves.
I have one patriarch at a time.
Yes, one at a time. There's one Nazi at a time.
Why do you say patriarch?
Patriarchate means the rule of the patriarch.
Over a period of time.
Yes, over a period of time.
Was this Severian period the second century before?
After. We're talking about after.
Okay.
Yes.
If I understand what you're saying correctly, they appointed local people to be judges.
Right.
And then these local judges were influenced by the Rabbanim.
That's right.
What was the secret ingredient that permitted these local people, once they were given power, to follow the dictates and the logic and the teachings of the rabbin? And why didn't they just say, we're the authorities and we'll do it our way?
Yeah, well, that was...
Which is much of what would have happened if that were to happen today.
Not so clear. Not so clear. I mean, one of the things...
What was the secret element?
The secret element was the political genius of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi and his successors in co-opting these people into the system.
True, making them. You give them a title, you give them power.
And you make them feel that they're...
Why make them listen to you?
Well, because of the fact that now it's become traditional that in order to be a judge you have to get power from the central authority. Somehow or other you become part of the system. And it worked. I mean, the fact of the matter is that instead of engaging in a bitter ideological internal battle with these people, or struggle for power, which was what most of the members of the Sanhedrin, that is what you call the Rabbanim, wanted, the Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi and his successors envisaged that we'll co-opt them into the system, they will participate in an educational program which will spread the values of the Torah simply because they are the representatives of the central authority, and thereby they will eventually lead to the spread of the authority of the central administration and the Torah, rather than being in opposition to it in order to demand their local rights. By being absorbed into the central system, he sort of deflated or deflected the battle of authority about who's in charge. And to sum up Professor Alon's thing, let's look on the bottom of page 430, where he writes, "What results emerge from this development? It seems that the actions of the patriarch were vindicated. The power of the central authority continued to increase. The joining of the heads of the cities to the rule of the patriarch enhanced its authority, but in like manner helped to stimulate the process of penetration of the influence of Torah scholars into the local population, and with it the stabilization of the religious spiritual world of the masses. Yet, it seems that in practice, the appointment of unqualified judges by the patriarch encouraged the predominance of Torah lawsuits, i.e. the judgments of the sages. Through their dependence on the supremacy of the patriarch, the two authorities came closer to one another and proceeded towards integration." So, historically, what Alon is saying is that this view, these actions of the patriarch, which were resented by the rabbis precisely because so-called incompetent judges, or judges who were coming from the rich classes, were being appointed officially to positions that they had no right to be, led eventually to the penetration of the ideology of the halacha and Torah study into the general scheme of things and the adoption of the halacha as a system. Yes? Yes?
Isn't he being somewhat or very slightly driven by a kind of Hegelian idealism, setting up all this stuff?
I don't know what you mean by Hegelian idealism.
He's creating a profile or a matrix here. And it very much parallels what people describe as the history of Grecian democracy and Roman democracy, in other words, where kind of populist compromise is involved. But is this actually true to the experience of the Jewish people?
Well, it's true to the experience of the Jewish people that by the end of the patriarch period, the halacha was triumphant. There were no longer local courts who tried to impose some independent system of law. It is also true that these local rebellions and the rejection of the authority of the halacha in deciding lawsuits bubbled up all over the place, as we will see in the next 1,500 years in various different communities. I don't mean to claim that this was an eternal triumph, but within gaining a homogeneous control over the legal structure of the population, historically, this is exactly what happened. We find complaints from the Rabbanim, from Chazal, throughout the period until about 150 years before the end. But by the end of this period, in fact, there were competent judges manning the Batei Din in the local communities. Now, you ask what would happen in modern times. Well, I don't know. The fact of the matter is, and I think that there is some lesson to be learned from modern times, if by modern times you mean this century and not this decade.
Yeah, what if the Hassan Sofer would have had the same policy vis-a-vis the reform movement?
Well, the Hassan Sofer couldn't have had the same policy vis-a-vis the reform movement because this was a rebellious movement from the start. And secondly, the Hassan Sofer did not have any overwhelming desire to include that population within his domain of authority. To the contrary, he wanted to exclude it. But I think that a more pertinent case is what was happening in the second decade of the century in Israel. Under the Turkish Empire, no one wanted to use the Turkish courts. I mean, they were just corrupt, inefficient, and everything else. So there were the rabbinical courts. The rabbinical courts weren't the most efficient, but at least they were honest, and they were imposed introducing halacha. On the other hand, there was a substantial portion of the population which was deviating from being strictly religious, and those people wanted, you know, to have a court system on which they would be represented, and they wanted to do that in such a way that they would bring in most of the ingredients of Jewish civil law, halacha, as it was applied in the Shulchan Aruch, as far as the issues of civil law were concerned. But they wanted their people, that is, their professors of law who had immigrated to Israel, or their lawyers and judges, to be part of the system. This was not accepted by Rav Kook. That is, Rav Kook did not have this same view that he would be able to. It was sort of beyond his, although he was very much open to and support of the irreligious element, the non-Shomrei Mitzvot element in the land at the time, he viewed this from his perspective of a stage in Messianic history when the irreligious element in Israel would be finally realized that they were unwittingly helping in the salvation of the country as a whole, which would then be restored to Messianic times when the Mashiach would come in one form or another and the rule of Halacha would obtain. So as a result, what happened was, and we'll review this when we get to the 20th century, as a result what happened was that these groups instituted their own court system called the Beit Mishpat HaShalom. This was a system which was set up in deliberate competition with the rabbinical courts, because the rabbinical courts would not allow as dayanim on their courts lawyers who were not shomrei mitzvah. And In these, when we study the history of the Beit HaMishpat HaShalom, you will see that many of the judges in this court system attempted to import many of the items of Jewish civil law, and with modifications, with changes, with bringing things up to date, and with some ingredients which were not part of the halacha. I mean, there are many aspects, as we will see, of civil law which developed since the time of the Shulchan Aruch, concepts which just simply don't exist in the Shulchan Aruch, like a corporation and other items. Well, this was exactly because Rebbe made the opposite decision that Rav Kook did. Instead of being rigid and excluding these people from any form of civil authority, he took them in. Now, what happened, in fact, was in the 1920s, the Beit Mishpat HaShalom, that is from the second half of the teens through the middle of the 1920s and for up to about 1930, the Beit Mishpat HaShalom was a legitimate competitor to the Batei Din HaRabbaniyim, and most, I would say, non-religious or non-observant Jews in Israel at the time would take their cases to the Beit Mishpat HaShalom rather than to the Beit Din HaRabbani. No one would want to take them to the Turkish courts. But with the onset of the mandate and the establishment of the British court system with British-trained jurists in the 1920s and 1930s, the British courts were much more efficient and seemed to have much more of a system than the Batei HaMishpat HaShalom, and therefore they simply, on free competition, drove the Batei HaMishpat HaShalom under. That is, by the end of the 1930s, civil cases were taken not to the irreligious Jewish courts, but rather to the courts which were manned by Jews, perhaps, or non-Jews, but dealing out British law rather than halacha. So that by the time of the establishment of the state, what happened was that the bulk of civil law in Israel was based on some mixture of British law, Napoleonic code, Islamic law as imposed by the Turkish Empire, but that one ingredient that was supplied by the Beit HaMishpat HaShalom, namely the Jewish civil law, was practically absent from the incorporation into the basic laws of the State of Israel. So, to answer your question, by having a particular vision of the future, which regarded the non-religious Jews as not having a long-term virtue in their own right, but rather being as an instrumental means to the eventual achievement of the Messianic state, and also, no doubt, because of his of being afraid of his right wing, Rav Kook did not allow the same form of co-optation of the non-religious element into the Jewish civil courts, and the eventual outcome of that was the non-incorporation of Jewish civil law into the civil law of the State of Israel at the time that the thing was founded in 48. Yes?
We have sources showing that Chazal disputed
Rebbe. Oh, yes. We did a lot of that last time, and in Alon's article you'll see citations of a lot of protests over this. Many of these protests against the ignorant judges, or even the title of his article, which is called Those Who Were Appointed for Money.
But those criticisms were of Rebbe himself?
It was of the entire system. This was a process that took over 100 or 150 years. Okay?
Do you think in the decision, when you co-opt, as you say, there's also what goes into the political strategy is usually the decision about being able to contain.
Yeah, sure. Co-op.
So Rebbe must have thought, This was a containable problem.
This was a containable problem, and he could live with the protest of his right wing. I mean, historically, we've seen many instances of where Pinchas Ben Yair, for example, was attacking Rebbe for many of his decisions from the right. He was able to balance the discontent that he was causing amongst his right wing with the vision that he was co-opting what you might call the left wing.
So I'm thinking Rebbe was thinking that he wouldn't have to revisit this problem in a few years and contain yet a larger group, whereas maybe Ralph Cook might have been concerned that it wasn't something he could contain by being inclusive.
That's a speculation. All I'm saying is that I'm questioning whether the politics of ideology in the long run is ideological exclusionism in the long run is a winning policy in trying to deal with questions which are a complicated mix of religious and political factors. And we will have many time to visit this as we go along. I'm simply saying that this is a process which is not necessarily restricted to the second and third centuries. And I don't know what Hegelian means, but I think that Alon makes a case for this having been a process. Well, why not do it publicly? You seem to question Alon's historical judgment here.
Well, not his judgment, but his process, because, Hegelians and post-modernists like Marx, for example, use the device in describing history in terms of thesis, antithesis, synthesis. And this thing we'll call the idea of progress or the idea of history. Now, I'm not a philosopher, but I studied this a bit in college. So Alon seems to follow that model of, X force by Y force, synthesis of things. And that may be a good model, but I wonder who
else. Well, I don't think that these are philosophical models. The fact that there had always, look, even today, we know that there's a local judiciary and that there's a state judiciary and there's a central government, U.S. government judiciary. And whereas there are on occasion conflicts between all of them, in various times that he was studying, there were conflicts, and he's trying to explain what these conflicts were. So I don't think that this is some philosophical position. There were these that competing political forces.
Yeah, and you answered my question earlier when you said you thought this was authentic and descriptive.
Right. Now, okay. So we have described the situation from the internal point of view. That is, from the point of view of Jewish self-government, completely or almost completely ignoring the fact that superimposed on all of this was the Roman administration. That is, the Jews did not constitute an independent state. They were subject to Roman control. And for example, just to give you an idea, the Yerushalmi in Sanhedrin says, Tani kodem la'arba'im shana ad shelo charav habayit nitlu dinei nefashot. 40 years prior to the destruction of the temple, the right to inflict capital punishment was taken away from the Jews. In the days of Shimon ben Yochai, that means right after the Bar Kokhba rebellion, even the right to adjudicate civil cases were taken away from the Jews. And maybe useful to just read parts of the handout that I gave last time, which is from this marvelous book of Linder, which quotes some of these edicts. Let's just quickly read through of them so we can get a picture of what things looked like from the point of view of the Roman administration. So, as I say, the right of Jewish courts to adjudicate all litigations between Jews continued throughout the pagan Roman Empire. For example, the decree of Lucius Antonius de Sardes stated that since the Jews had proved to him that they had an assembly of their own according to the laws of their forefathers, and this from the beginning, and also a place of their own wherein they determined their lawsuits and controversies with one another, he ordered that these privileges be preserved. In other words, at that particular juncture, the right of the Jewish communities to adjudicate their own disputes in their own courts was preserved. Diocletian in 293 writes, "The agreement of private individuals does not make a judge one who is not in charge of any jurisdiction. Neither has his decision the force of a legal verdict." In other words, there is such a notion of an official judge, but not just simply by a man off the street. And in fact, what were these judges? This is clear from Constantine the Great. those who dedicated themselves with complete devotion to the synagogues, to the patriarchs or to the presbyters, etc., were free of the liturgies. In other words, at the time of Constantine the Great, this final status as described by Rabbi Abahu, namely that the judges were appointed by some combination of the patriarch of the Nasi on the one hand and the Sanhedrin on the other, was recognized by the Roman authorities. So, and if we go further, just see a few more quotes here. We read last time the fact that if someone is put on cherem, for whatever reason or other, he's excommunicated, then the only judge who can remove the cherem, who can eliminate the excommunication, has to be one who is in fact appointed by the patriarch and by the Sanhedrin. There's an interesting note 22 on my page 2 here, my page 78 of last week's handout, a prohibition of Jewish marriage customs. Theodosius 393, near 393, none of the Jews shall keep his customs and marriage unions, neither shall he contract nuptials according to his law, or enter into several matrimonies at the same time. So Theodosius tried to outlaw Jewish control over marriage and divorce, and in particular to outlaw polygamy, and this was one of the Roman edicts that was never been able to carry out, because as we know, up until again the beginning of the 19th century, our communities fought very hard that we should have complete control over marriage and divorce, which is of course again
why would the Romans want to get involved in.
Because the Romans were a government.
Well, they could say, why do we need the
why does the United States get involved and say that the Mormons can't marry more than one wife? Why is it any business of...
They throw out a court a lot of things as a religious question.
Right, but they haven't thrown out of court the issue that a Mormon, at least according to the laws of the United States, and even the laws of the state of Utah, the way they're officially written, cannot marry more than one wife.
But they do.
Whether in fact they do or do not, I don't know.
But well, recently there was an article where they...
I'm sure that it may very well be that they do, but the state, as a well-organized state, wants to have some say in the issues of marriage and divorce. And in particular, just as the United States government felt compelled to outlaw polygamy, the Roman administration also wanted to outlaw polygamy. Yes?
But in the case of Utah, it was absolutely a condition of statehood, which was rejected first by the Mormons and then forced upon them.
Whatever.
You know, I'm just saying.
But the central state likes to have... the more organized and legal the central state is, the more it wants to impose what it views as the right law, and in this particular case, outlawing polygamy, which was contrary to official Jewish law at the time, was one of the moves of the Roman government. So they wanted to control marriage and divorce.
Maybe that would cut down population growth by not having...
I don't know that they were interested in that or not interested in that. In every single state of the Union of the United States, you can't get married without, or at least it's illegal to get married or divorced without that being an authorized official act of the state. Now, it may be that we maintain our religious version of marriage and divorce, and the conflict between these two, of course, is one of the sources of incredible problems today. But why should the government of the United States be interested in marriage and divorce? In what business does the government of the United States have in regulating a private contract between two individuals? But they do. So this is a fact that the Roman government tried to take the marriage laws out of the hands of the Jews and in fact to prohibit polygamy, and in this one they didn't succeed. In many other things they did succeed.
I don't know if there's that ability, but living together is so prevalent that the government is not involved.
Living together is prevalent today, but it wasn't prevalent 50 years ago.
You make an issue about living together.
Well, it may very well be. Depends who you get elected as the next president of the United States. If you elect Buchanan as the next president of the United States, you may have some...
Okay.
All right, let's take a look at the regulation of Arcadius in 396. This will be of importance to us to see, to compare with what was happening in Babylon at a slightly earlier time. No one outside the religion of the Jews shall establish prices for the Jews when merchandise is offered for sale, for it is just to assign to each man what is his own. Province governors shall not allow, therefore, that a controller or supervisor be appointed over you. But if someone shall dare to seize this office except you and your leaders, then they shall hasten to repress them with the penalty imposed upon the usurpers of another property. In other words, in places where the Jews controlled the markets, they also had the right to have their own official control market prices. There was such a thing as fixing the prices in the market. This was done by an official of the local government or the local community. And what Arcadius is saying is that this right could not be taken away from the Jews or superimposed on them by some other authority. Let's take a look at the most famous edict on the judicial powers of the Jewish authorities. Again, this is in the year 398. The Jews who live under the Roman common law shall address in the usual way the courts in those cases which do not concern so much as their superstition as court laws and rights, and all of them shall bring actions and defend themselves under the Roman law. In other words, civil law should be in the hands of the Roman courts. In conclusion, they shall be under our laws. But now comes the one big loophole. Certainly, if some of them shall deem it necessary to litigate before the Jews or the patriarchs through mutual agreement, the Latin term is per compromissum, which we saw was in the Yerushalmi last week, in the matter of arbitration, with the consent of both parties, and in civil matters only, they shall not be prohibited by the public law from accepting their verdict. The governors of the provinces shall even execute their sentences as if they were appointed arbiter to a judge's award. In other words, even though officially the Jews should bring their cases before the Roman courts, but since there is such a notion as a court-appointed arbitrator, the Romans recognized all the Jewish judges as legitimate court-appointed arbitrators to adjudicate cases between Jews, and furthermore would carry out the decisions of such Jewish judges as they would carry out the decisions of any court-appointed arbitrator. So in fact, autonomy still prevailed. And therefore, the statements that we see in the Gemara here and there to condemn those who turned to the Roman courts was just simply to be sure that they maintained their adherence to these local Jewish judges who were still acting as, within the Jewish community, as the official courts, externally as boards of arbitration, which whose decisions would be enforced by the Roman authorities. So the... what's the problem?
No, the problem is exactly the same thing.
Well, we will see if it is or isn't the same as today, because we will see what the actual method of operation of the local Batei Dinim in fact are. But we will see. Okay, I should say that this Roman famous decision of Arcadius, which was a continuation of something that came from before of Theodosius, even persisted into Western Europe several centuries later. We're getting ahead of ourselves, but let me read something that Professor Linder quotes in his second book, which describes all the Roman, that is, all the sources in Latin pertaining to the Jews then in the Middle Ages in Europe. There's something called the Monk's Epitome. This is from an 8th century manuscript written somewhere in Western Europe at the request of his abbot. This is what he writes. It's a little bit unclear what he's saying. On the Jews, all the Jews should determine the cases which they have amongst themselves according to their law. But on those which they have with Christians, they should litigate according to our laws before the judge of the province. If both parties should consent and wish to be heard in a civil case, it will be as though it was determined by order of the judge of the province. I haven't a clue as to what that last sentence means. Who are these both parties? Are these both parties being two Jews, or is it a Jew and a Christian? It's not clear which of the previous sentences it refers to, but the point that I'm making is that this decision of the Roman emperors persisted into Western Europe and in medieval times. So when we get to that, we will see that it was a direct continuation of the Roman viewpoint imposed on the various local laws, which by this time had changed entirely. They were no longer administering Roman law, but rather Frankish law or Germanic law or what have you. And we'll see that the whole attitude towards the law in general on the part of the populace changed drastically from Roman times to medieval times. And this will have some consequences for us. Okay, so much for what was happening on the in Israel and within the Roman Empire. Now we have
to treat all the other empires the same way they treated the Jews, or they just gave the Jews special rights.
That's disputed amongst the scholars. Some of them, like the Greek cities, had many rights, and many and some people some had less. And to what extent the Jews represented an exception amongst the conquered territories, and to what degree they represented as an exception, is something which is in some form of scholarly dispute. Since I can't read the original sources, I can only, I just don't know enough Greek, or any Greek, nor do I know enough Latin to be able to read these sources fluently myself. I just have to rely on what the experts tell me in this matter. He discusses them. He implies that there were worse.
That other book.
Yes, I know, but his view is not universally accepted. Jews in their land and Talmudic
Talmud.
Okay. Okay, now, I now want to spend the rest of this year and probably most, if not all, of the next year discussing what was happening in Babel. Remember, in Israel, we had, at the beginning of the period, we are discussing local courts, local authorities, and we also had two centralized authorities. There was the Nasi, that is the patriarch, and the Sanhedrin. I know that there are some more recent scholars who question the existence of one or the other of these two things, but the evidence is overwhelming for both of them. There existed two bodies which represented the central administration at this time: the Sanhedrin, which was the body of the Chachamim, of the Rabbanim, and the Nasi, the patriarch.
They worked with each other.
They worked with and against each other. Not independent, but sometimes in conflict. They did not always agree, and there was sometimes some struggle for ascendancy. Okay. I now want to turn to what was happening in Babel. Here, as we will find, not only are the sources more difficult to disengage, but the conflict between the current historians are the extremes. So what you will be getting are my views, not necessarily the accepted views of some standard great scholar like Alon or Lieberman or someone like that. Yes?
How do you explain the effect of the bubble was such a sense of fusion?
I'm not sure I understand your question.
What I'm trying to say is that there was a sense of Talmud study in Babel.
When?
On Talmud
path. When? Well, that's going to be part of our problem. What we certainly know was that there was a large Jewish population in what we call Babel, and this Jewish population had subsisted there from the time of the first exile, and we also know that the establishment of the Second Temple was basically done by people who came from Babel. So there was an ancient center. I mean, if we read some standard book, like, say, Olmsted's History of the Persian Empire, which sort of comes to the end, at the end of the first Persian Empire, I'm reading from this book, but it's not a particularly good book or a particularly bad one. So the revolt in Egypt, he's now talking about 400 or 500 BC, right? 500 and something BC. To the revolt of Egypt was added the Athenian raid on Phoenicia. In Judah, an anonymous prophet whom we call Malachi was preaching the coming of the day of the Lord with its summons to open rebellion. Attention was thus focused on the critical situation in Judah. Just at this time, Ezra presented to the court a scheme of Jewish reorganization which made a strong appeal to Artaxerxes. In the official hierarchy, Ezra held a double office. He was the priest, the acknowledged religious leader of his own people, the Jews of Babylonia, the ancestor of the head of exile in later times. How he knows this, I don't know. He certainly wasn't the ancestor in any biological sense, because the heads of the exile in later times attributed to themselves Davidic ancestry, and Ezra was a Kohen. He also was the scribe of the law of the God in heaven, or as we may say, the secretary of state for Jewish affairs, responsible to the king for his community. Though he was interested in a genuine colonization of the weak Jerusalem, his chief desire was to introduce to the Jews of Palestine the law of Moses as set forth in the law book. Jews of Babylonia were often substantial citizens. As against the natives, they could be trusted to be loyal, and so on and so forth. And then he quotes the famous passages from Ezra, in which his appointments by Korach, by Artaxerxes was sent with, and so on, the problems of the elimination of the non-Jewish lives, and so on. All of this is taking place at the beginning of the Second Temple period. So much of what we know as Judaism today is certainly, in no small measure, in fact, in a major measure, attributed to